And now we want to talk with the exiles in our audience about what you left behind. We'll speak in a moment with Ariel Dorfman, the writer and activist forced to abandon his home in Santiago after the coup that overthrew President Salvador Allende in Chile 40 years ago. In a new essay, he writes that, yes, of course he missed friends and family, Santiago and its mountains. He mourned the dead and a future that would never be. But maybe most of all, he missed his library, the books he'd accumulated over the years. Exiles, what did you leave behind that still calls to you? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Ariel Dorfman's essay in the Chronicle of Higher Education is based on his new book, Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile, and he joins us from the studios at NPR West. And Ariel, nice to have you back with us again.
I'm so glad to be with you again, Neil.
And there's a story you tell in your essay about learning that your home in Santiago had been used as a safe house by the underground. This was, I guess, about a year after you left.
Yes, this was a very strange experience. I mean, we had not wanted to sell the house because my library was there. And while the library was there, we knew that somehow we were going back. It was like an anchor in the middle of the ever-shifting swamp of uncertainty of what exile does to you. You lose everything, but there's something to go back to. So while that was there, it was like something intact was part of my life waiting for me. And then we thought, you know, we have to sell this because we're penniless here. We haven't got a home. We're living off charity. So let's sell it. And then all of a sudden we realized, the crazy thing is we realized because a journalist, we had put a clandestine journalist into Chile to interview a member of the resistance against General Pinochet. And he came back and we debriefed him. And all of a sudden he begins to describe this house where he had met this leader of the resistance. And he says, it's full of books. There are books even in the bathroom. The bathroom has a large portrait of Bob Dylan with his hair on fire. And there were books even in the kitchen, you know. There were books everywhere. And he said, do you know a house like that? And I looked at my wife and I nudged her in the table. Oh, no, we don't know anything. And he was describing our own house. So it was very strange to see through his eyes the fact that our house was there and that our library was, in fact, intact and still spilling over in all the directions. So we, in a sense, we said, well, we can't sell the house now anymore, of course, because now we know it's being used by the resistance. Even, of course, they didn't have the grace to tell us that our house might be raided by the police and that my library might go up in smoke along with the house itself, right, and with people who were inside it.
In the end, several years after that, you found yourself still in exile, this time in the United States, in even more dire economic straits, and now more than, well, 8 or 9 years after after the coup, it was not realizing that it was going to be reversed tomorrow.
You're right. I mean, we, you know, exiles always think like the old thing, tomorrow in Jerusalem or tomorrow in Tehran or wherever. And you say tomorrow in Santiago, but then we realize it's not even the day after tomorrow. Pinochet was very consolidated in power. And we realized that we just had to understand that it was impossible for us to continue living this penurious existence, and we needed to sell the only thing we had, which was this house. So we sold the house when we were in Washington, and then the books were all boxed by my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law and sent to a dear friend who lived up in the hills of Santiago. And I thought, at least, you know, it's boxed there. He'll take care of it. And he put it in this sort of a hutch next to rabbits and chicken coops and things like that. So I suppose they weren't going to read the books. And then one day he calls me up on the phone and he says, Ariel, I have really bad news. Tengo malas noticias in Spanish, he said. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's somebody's died. Something's terrible has happened. And it wasn't terrible, something had happened, fortunately, to any human being, though always the phone brought bad news in that sense.
Sure.
Because it always came through, you know, your heart would sink and think, my gosh, who is it this time? Who I've got to contact? What life I've got to save? But in this case, he said, you know, the river flooded and it took half your library. And I said, half my library. And strangely enough, I was consoled by this. Because in a strange way, at that point, after 8 or 9 years in exile, I had ceased to believe in the library. They existed in my head. But I had gone through, I would spend nights at home in the dark, sort of trying to imagine the order of the different books, the classics here and Shakespeare here and the books in Spanish here and the books, you know, where they were, all these books that I had accumulated. I put all my extra money I didn't have, I put all into the library. It was my sort of the aspiration that I had towards liberation and towards the life I wanted to lead, the peaceful life I wanted to read and lead, right, and write. And so, strangely enough, by saying half your books are gone with the river and the others sort of caked with mud, he made them tangible. He made them real to me. It's very strange, you know, you lose half of something and then you realize the other half is still there. It really exists. And then when I went back to Chile in 1990, I was able to resurrect that part of the library, clean it up, and put it away. It's still in Chile, by the way, a large part of those books.
It's interesting. You write, I went on to indulge my fantasy. There was a boy who helped you named Miguel. With all the Miguels remaining behind with me, Miguel de Cervantes and Miguel Angel Asturias and Miguel Street by Naipaul and, of course, Michel de Montaigne. What did he say, my Michel, about poverty and the mind? I shuffled through the cold to the almost full library and found the essays perched close to Eluard and Rabelais. I opened the volume until I came to the phrase underlined by a furious pencil that once had been mine. Poverty of goods is easily cured. Poverty of the mind is irreparable. And at that moment, you realized, you had changed as your library had changed.
I had changed very much. You know, there was this little boy called Miguel who was working with his father, who was a mason. And the incredible thing was that he had not had a chance to have a library like mine. Because of the Pinochet dictatorship, his fate would be to be uneducated. He was not going to be able to grow up to have these books or the possibility of these books, you know. And in fact, I was at the L.A. Library last night reading, and I was thinking about all the Miguels in Los Angeles and all the Miguels in the United States who should have a chance to go to the library and have their own identity cards, even if their parents are undocumented, that they know that they have the desire of that and the possibility of that. And I was just thinking about that the loss of the library is not the loss only of the library. It's the loss of the ideal that someday those libraries will be available for all the people of Chile and all the people of the world. I mean, my vision of the world is a world where everybody has access to the library. Everybody, we belong to this. After all, the library is where all that was written ever from the very, very immemorial times, everything that ever will be written, digital or not, comes together and jostles together in one mind, the gigantic mind of the wondrous, glorious humanity that we are. And that somehow, when there is poverty of that sort, the poverty of mind that is created by dictatorship, many of those books will not be available. And there will be something which will be irreparable, like what may have happened to this child. You know, the child went off with a big tip, some books that I gave him, very reluctantly. I don't like to get rid of my books, but he really needed some books. And then I thought to myself, he's gone, and I won't see him again. And what's going to happen to this boy? What happens to all the lost children? So there's a lost library and there's a lost children. And someday I can only pray, you know, that there will be no more lost libraries and no more lost children.
We're talking with Ariel Dorfman about the library that he left behind when he went into exile. Exiles, what did you leave behind that still calls to you? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Nico's on the line with us from San Francisco.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call, Neil.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Nico's obviously having a difficult time hearing us. One more time, can you hear us? I guess not. I apologize.
Yeah, I was breaking up for a second.
Oh, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can. Thank you. You probably overdosed on stories about Iran, but I miss my piano, which my family, as we left Iran in 1978, we left behind. And I never took up piano again after that and sort of faded away until about 4 or 5 years ago. But I think back of all the joy I had playing piano in the back of the house in a special room we had, and it's gone.
What was the tune that was your favorite?
I don't recall any particular tunes. I was going to a music school and I had private lessons, and it was just escape. It was a fun instrument. It was a fun room to be in. The house is gone, of course, and everything else in it. But my most important memory of that house was the piano that I left behind.
And you will, you expect never see it again.
The house was later occupied by people who had lost their home during the war between Iran and Iraq in the 80s. So they occupied the house at some point. I have no idea what happened to everything that was inside.
Miko, thank you very much for the story. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
You know, Neil, it's extraordinary that there are things you can't take with you. You know, you can't take the biggest objects like a piano. But you can always take the memory of them. And I think Nico has that memory. And in some sense, I think at times we just have to deal with the fact that that's how life turns out.
Let's see if we go next to, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this, Panapur in Richmond, Virginia. Correct me on the pronunciation, if you would.
It's Panapur Early.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My thing is I left from Liberia in 1990 during the Civil War and came to the United States and been in school. But one of the things that, like your guest, I left my books in the house. And when I went back last year to visit, my brothers and my family, my parents are dead, but my brothers, they had kept my books because they knew how much they were important to me. So I was able to get some of the books and bring some of them to the United States. So I just wanted to share that because, like you were saying, the memories that you have of those things stay with you. And I'm just an example of that.
And books, I'm not a musician like Miko, but like Ariel, I read a lot too. Books help define who you are. They're the people you learn to explore the world with.
Exactly.
Which particular volume meant the most important to you?
Well, among those books, actually, the ones that were important to me were ones that I can't say on the air, but like the Communist Manifesto and those kind of
things. Ariel, I think you had a couple of those books, too.
I did indeed. No, but those books we had to burn after after the coup. You would look out at the streets of Santiago, and there were the chimneys. It was spring, so nobody was cold, but all the chimneys were spouting smoke because people were burning books. They were burning the books. And in fact, they were even burning things like Picasso's red period or something like that, because the red and the black, because they thought by Stendhal, because then the people would come in and say, this is a red book, you're under arrest. And then there was a book called The Cubist Movement. This is true, where somebody said, oh, you're with the Cuban Revolution. No, it's the Cubist Movement. And they would take them prisoner, you know,
and interrogate them. Not so funny then.
No, but there was smoke. And I always thought that smoke that came from different places of Santiago and mingled in the air was in some strange way like the incineration of the books, but the books were speaking to each other as they floated away into the air. So the Communist Manifesto, I didn't find it when I came back because my wife had got rid of it.
Panapu, thanks for the call. We're glad you got your books back.
Thank you.
We're talking with Ariel Dorfman. His new book is, his essay, My Lost Library, is published in the Chronicle Review. His new book is Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Enrique is next. Enrique calling from Boston.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good,
this
thanks.
This is a great topic. And I emigrated from Venezuela to Boston. And, you know, leaving behind, you know, that's a broad question. I left behind everything, all, you know, my entire half of my life, memories about places, about people, relationships. And a couple of them are really interesting for me. One was my parents had a little beach house in the west of the country. It was just like a little paradise. And I have now two kids that were born here in the U.S., and I wanted them to share the joy of being in that house. And the parents already, they're living here in the U.S. After a few years, And my hope was to kind of take my kids to see and stay in the house and then see, go to the beach and enjoy the way I did when I was growing up. But then my dad informed me last year that he sold the house. So that was like, you know, my last kind of reasons for going back to my country, other than kind of visiting some friends. And that was kind of sad, really. I was surprised to be depressed by that. I'm not really attached to it, but that was kind of a really sobering for me, like cutting the last cord kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the second was, and I'm pretty sure, Ariel, that you know Ernesto Sabato.
Oh, yes.
He had a little book that was given to us in high school called Hombres y Granajes, meaning...
Yes,
and machinery. I forget. I don't know the translation. The point of the book, there was a quote there that said, "Any young man that hasn't been a socialist hasn't lived a life," or something like that.
Uh huh.
So I try to retrieve that quote, and I couldn't find it. And then I asked my mom on one of their trips down there to pick up the book. So now that's kind of the only book I have from my library down there that still is in boxes somewhere.
You know, when he said that this was his little paradise, I had chills. And I thought, wow, that's a great title for all the books about exile. Because it's not the big paradise that you miss. It's the little paradises that you miss. It's those little things that make life worth living and that have been taken from you. And you just have to build another little paradise somewhere else.
Absolutely. And I think the point is, you know, you can go to Cape Cod or go to any great beach here in the U.S. and there's a lot of good places. But you're never going to see that rock when you saw that little girl or you know, that when you were 14, you saw a 13-year-old that really, you know, had your heart beat rate.
Oh, yeah.
And that's gone. Like, you're never going to see that rock unless you go back to the country and be there. But
the tree where you stole your first kiss, it's gone.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, guys. This is a great topic, and, you know, I think it'll paint a good color around immigration. I hope that it does.
Enrique, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Bye.
And Ariel, we hope eventually you are reunited with all of your remaining books.
Well, I'm hoping that someday I will take part of the books from Chile and part of the books from the States, and then I will be whole or almost entirely whole, right? And I'll let you know then. We'll do a program about the found library, the resurrection of the libraries of all the Miguels of the world.
And the truly interesting stuff, how do you arrange it all? Ariel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Steele.
Ariel Dorfman, his new book is Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile. We'll see you again on Monday. We're going to be talking about mid-sized companies that might rescue the American economy. Join us for that. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.